Welcome to DevCast, brought to you by Devrel Smith, the right people. DevCast is where property meets people, industry figures, news and views, what it takes to be your best. So sit back, earphones on, and enjoy this edition of DevCast.
Welcome to DevCast, Devrel Smith's audio series, which holds exclusive and thought-provoking interviews with professionals of the property industry. My name's Andrew Devrel Smith. I'm founder of Devrel Smith, and today I'm joined by Chief Executive of Metropolitan Thames Valley Housing, Geeta Nanda. Geeta has worked in the housing sector for over 25 years in housing associations, local government, and research. Previously, she was Group Director of Operations at Notting Hill Housing Trust and has served on many boards. Including, I think, McCarthy and Stone being one of them, the retirement development house builder. So prior to joining Metropolitan Thames Valley, Geeta served over 9 years as Chief Executive of Thames Valley Housing Association before the merger in 2017. Is that correct? Is that the correct intro, Geeta?
I think so. I think
that. Are you happy with that?
It just sounds like an awful lot of years.
It sounds pretty impressive to me. So thank you. Thank you for joining me in what is quite a unique time, I guess, for all of us across the world. Late April 2020. How are you personally? How are you and yours, if I can put it like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a very different way of working and leading an organisation through this change. So I would say that we're all in good spirits. We're trying our best. We're amazed at some of the things we've been able to achieve, actually. I think it's quite incredible about how organisations can completely shift and change their model. But yeah, we're all good.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. So on that, and you're right, I think it's been remarkable how quickly people, governments, charities, you name it, can move so quickly. But what would you say has been the one thing in the past 5 or 6 weeks that what's been the most fundamental change?
Well, I think it's been the fact that we've got, you know, 1,900 people working for us and we're all working from home. And we have completely focused on those frontline, members of staff who are focusing on the customer. It's just been a complete sort of right side up model that we call it of, you know, really thinking about the customer in the front line and how do we serve them best as an organization, and you know, the safety and security of our colleagues and our customers, you know, that's been absolutely fundamentally the one driver through all of this. So having that one big problem that everybody is focusing on in the whole organisation, rather than the 50 things we're running around doing it normally, has been, it's meant really come together as an organisation, but it's meant a very different way of working as well.
Wow. And so is that right? So every single employee of the organisation is working from home. I presumed there would have been a split of some sort, but...
No, I mean, obviously we've got, if you think about the different kind of industries or businesses within a housing association, you know, we have a property business, a repairs business. So we have workers going out into people's homes and they've always worked, you know, out of a van and, from an office, but in their vehicle to people's homes. We've got care and support staff working in our supported schemes, in our care homes. And so they've always been based really within those schemes, and then everybody else has been based in an office and provided services to people, and all of them, from our call centres to our some of our sales teams who were working in sales offices, etc. Everybody's working from home, and we're working with new digital models that we've introduced and different, completely different ways of working. And I think that is the absolutely the biggest change that we've had.
I'm sure, I don't disagree. I've had a number of conversations right across our client base, and I think that's it. Yeah. And what's your view on that in terms of the future? You know, what will your flexible policies look like?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we have this great ambition as an organisation to be, you know, more flexible, more agile in terms of how we work and where we work. And, you know, we thought the culture's change and the shift that's going to be required in order to get there was going to take us years. Yeah. But there's been massive gains over this short period of time. But I think it's also highlighted, you know, we've seen more members of staff who are kind of concerned about their own mental health well-being through this time, through being stuck at home. We know people need to be in an office. They need to see their teammates. So I think it helps you sort of focus on what is the purpose of an office, you know, because there are lots of ways we can communicate. We've completely changed all our ways of communicating. And, you know, I'm certainly communicating more directly, you know, more easily, really, with all our staff. So we've changed our ways of communicating, and we've changed our ways of thinking of a team. And, you know, we've done little tips for how managers can manage from a distance and how do you keep your team motivated, etc. And I think all of those techniques will come into play. But I do think people do need that social interaction of their team and coming together. And not everybody really likes working from home. You know, you've got people working on the end of their bed because they've haven't got enough space, and, you know, they've got kids around them, and it's not easy. Not everybody's got a great, you know, spare study or a spare bedroom that they can sit in and have a quiet quiet space.
Right to my world. I'm sitting in my 10-year-old yeah. bedroom at the moment, yeah. about 2 feet from his, but thankfully he's given me a bit of privacy for us to have this chat. So,
well, it's really wonderful when you're having a meeting and somebody's kid comes up to them and starts pulling faces into somebody's dog starts barking and everybody turns and looks at the dog or the baby or something. I think it's quite nice. It's quite human, isn't it, really?
I think that's it. For sure, there are going to be some things that I think are here to stay, or expectations. When I put my lens on in terms of, you know, the talent or candidate pools and what questions they may be asking in the future, I think some of these opportunities or issues will be high up on the agenda.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you, obviously, a lot of this chat is going to be COVID related, I suppose, because I guess every single conversation, you know, friends, family, professionally are COVID related at the moment. But as a CEO of a major organization, when you realized COVID, it was here and it was serious and it was a real thing, I guess that took us all slightly different amounts of time to accept. Once you came to that state of acceptance and understanding, what was the one area of your business that consumed most, you know, your immediate brain power? What did you worry about the most or think about first?
I think it was really around those colleagues of ours who are most at risk and our customers that are most at risk. So, you know, we house obviously a large number of more vulnerable customers who would, you know, are shielding or are older or, have underlying health conditions. And also, you know, the people who are most affected by this are younger people, more women who work in those health professions. There's a sort of bigger impact for a core group of poorer people as well who are losing their jobs or in those hospitality industries, etc. These are all the people we house. So, there's a big impact for key workers, and there's a big impact for us in terms of dealing with those customers. And then, of course, we have, we're very vulnerable people, whether it's learning disabilities, mental health problems, you know, or older people. We have a number of supported schemes, and our immediate concerns were really around all the things that are being talked about in the news. You know, have they got the right PPE? Can they, they're going into work and quite, and these are some of the poorest paid people that we have in society, and they're absolutely completely committed to being there and supporting their customers and being with those residents during this difficult time. So it was, for us, it was really around the health and safety and requirements of those most vulnerable customers and those most and those staff that are supporting those customers. And you know, very quickly we started getting quite a lot of information as we started being proactive and ringing all those customers we knew were vulnerable and finding out what position they were in and what help they needed. We gained a huge amount of information in a very short period of time, and that allowed us to really partner up with other organisations within local authorities to get support to those residents. And I think just completely working in a different way to put them first. And, you know, that was our first concern. I mean, the other thing really was we've still got all these regulatory things that we need to do. We need to do gas compliance checks in people's homes. You know, we've got to do electrical checks. So we had a whole raft of things, and there were no clear government guidance at that point. At that point, you know, like you say, everybody, it kind of, the penny dropped in many different ways in organisations. And we were thinking, well, should we be going and doing a gas check? Well, will we be prosecuted if we don't do that? What about fire safety works that are being undertaken? You know, the construction sites were closing down, and those are decisions that were being made by, you know, different developers, contractors, etc. And we were trying to work out what was the right thing to do in every situation. And then as the weeks went by, you got more guidance and more information about what you should be doing. But I think it's really about fast decision making. You know, you make a decision based on the information you've got as quickly as possible, and then you review it. Some of the things we got right, some of the things we got wrong, or we just reviewed it and changed it.
I think it's amazing. I'm always in awe of people who sit on the top of such large people organisations, because then there are more decisions naturally that have to be made. What would you say is your style of leadership around these kind of crisis management? You clearly couldn't make every decision. So what were your instructions?
Well, we got a core group of people together. You know, so we have a sort of emergency planning group, and they are then tasked with getting the information. You know, what are the decisions we need to make today? What's the information we're getting back from the business? Getting everybody, you know, how are we going to communicate and cascade the information, and how are we going to get the information back up from the front line so that we can make these emergency decisions? So it's just that real kind of crisis mode where you have to have your plan in place. You have to have the right people. There are some people who are brilliant at this. You know, I'm always in awe of them. They're there. They know exactly, you know, what box to tick and how to pull the plan together and do it very quickly. And you really rely on those people in these situations and circumstances.
Definitely. And are those people, had you already identified those people within the business, or did they come to the fore at the time of the crisis?
You know? Well, I think there are some people who, you know, within their titles, within their jobs, are automatically, you know, dedicated really to thinking about those business continuity plans in crisis. So our chief information officer was key, and his technology team, at getting within 4 days the whole organisation working from home. And, you know, any tenant can ring up and gets a kind of same service and same response from somebody working from home as they were in the office. But that was a huge, huge task of getting laptops to everybody. You know, we were on a journey to getting there, but we weren't expecting to do it this quickly. So, you know, there are such key people who kind of have, you know, have the plans, know what to do, know how to enact them. We're already thinking about this before we were even putting in place some of the systems and structures in place to do our sort of emergency planning. They were already thinking, right, we're going to need more laptops, we're going to need more things if this takes off. So yeah, it's about having a sort of crisis group and the right people around there who are there to make the immediate decisions. And then of course you've got to look longer term at, you know, what comes next and what's the strategy and how's the strategy going to change based on the information you've got. But that immediate core group of people is, you know, they work day and night. You know, we were just there, like you say, early till whatever time, over weekends, all night, just, you know, planning it to get it put in place. And then you can take a bit of a breather for about 2 seconds before you have to start the next thing.
Yeah, I'm a recruiter, so I think this might be a natural point in the conversation to ask you, what do you look for in people when you're interviewing and people, I guess, to join a leadership role or within this one of those crisis management positions perhaps, but what are the first things you look for in individuals when you interview them?
I think I look for attitude. Everybody's got to be flexible. It's a fast changing world. So it's have people got the right attitude to do the job. A lot of things can be learnt. I mean, obviously different jobs need people with the right experience as well. Who could demonstrate the experience they've got and can apply it. But I think really a lot of it has to do with, what sort of culture do they like working in? Are they collaborators? Will they work in the sort of style and culture that we're trying to engender within the organisation? And then have they got the flexibility and the attitude to really apply themselves to different situations? Because we're commercial, we're public, we're independent, we're partners, we're everything in a housing association. So you need people who are very multi-talented that can apply different skills in different situations.
What do you think it is that you've had such a successful career already? I mean, I was doing my research prior to this call, and you achieved some heady heights in a short space of time, and that momentum appears to have continued. What do you think it is that's driven that?
Well, I think a lot of luck. I do feel lucky. I think I always surround myself with really good people who are different to me, that can really sort of stretch our thinking. I think I'm somebody who is willing to take risks and make mistakes for a bigger game, for the organisation. So, you have to have the right risks and you have to, consider them quite carefully. But I do think we run amazing organisations. We're incredibly, I feel very lucky about every job I've had, and being in the sector for a long time, because you can flex and adapt what you do depending on the situation. So, we're ideal partners right now when, organisations step forward to continue developing and building. If the right tools are there and the right money is there, we can do that. If you're talking about the most vulnerable or the key workers in society, we have quite an in-depth knowledge and view of them. As well as that, we're also connected to, with Fizzy living our market rent subsidy, we really understand what's happening to younger people. We know exactly what's happening to the money they're earning. Because we've got data across everybody, all bits of society. And I just think that makes us incredibly flexible organisations, so we can flex according to circumstances. So I think, part of my success is really thinking about what does that mean? What's the next step? What does that mean for us? And how do we change according to the economy, according to the sort of government needs, according to the societal needs, really?
Well, so that was my next sort of area for you must have read my script, but the question is, what role do housing associations play in a post-COVID world? Like, what do you think about that?
Well, I think we all have to know what a post-COVID world looks like, which is, there's a lot of assumptions at the moment, isn't there? Nobody quite knows what's going to happen, and we can all look to Asia or different places to see what's going to happen to the economy. But some part of me thinks, is this some part of the correction we need? Is there going to be a housing market correction which is going to adjust things and make it easier for younger people to get on the housing ladder, etc.? Is this a correction for really valuing those people who work day and night in our economy, who people don't think about a lot of the time, the bus drivers, the shelf stackers, the drivers that bring our groceries, the care workers that are sitting holding parents, people's parents' hands, you know, at a time when they can't be there. These are all people in society that don't get talked about a lot and don't get recognised a lot. And, you know, I think in a post-COVID world, here's hoping that we will think about them more, and we will be able to do a sort of Homes for Heroes initiative for these absolute key workers, you know, in the same way we used council housing to rebuild it for people coming from the war. Maybe, you know, this is the time for us to come together and say, let's build properly affordable homes for, you know, those essential workers in society. So I think, you know, there's a big role for us really to promote, you know, promote that. And I do think people are going to think differently about, if so many people are using their jobs and claiming universal credit, they might think differently about people who claim benefits, or, you know, who have long-term illnesses. So I hope we will be a kinder world, and, you know, we will think about society in a slightly different way. I know there's been quite a lot of discussion around, you know, a sort of a universal benefit, you know, whether there's a basic income in some countries, you know, that is applied to everybody. I think maybe there'll be some different thinking around some of those things, even rent controls, you know, what are the things people are thinking about? And I think there'll be some discussion, even if there's no change, there will be some discussion around these things. How do we support people?
Well, I hope there is change. This is such a seismic event, isn't it? That if this doesn't change us, I'm not sure what will. But what would, so, what would disable you, Thames Valley, from producing, you know, so from ramping up that capacity? What's the biggest challenge for you in doing that? Is it funding, or is it land, or is it planning, or is it construction? Or
funding, yeah. I mean, it's funding, because, you know, we have a business model which was pretty stretched before, which is, you know, cross-subsidy of sales income into producing affordable homes. Grant rates on rented homes have been low, and we've been pushing our balance sheets and pushing everything in order to produce more. And, you know, I think there's been lots of successful things that have been developed, like through joint ventures and utilising different skills and bringing, you know, public land in, etc. But I don't think, unless we have the right funding structure now, we won't be able to increase our capacity, because, you know, we just won't be able to afford to. I think there's some quite interesting financing, you know, investors that are coming along, but they all want safe returns. You know, they want a nice, consistent, safe return. That doesn't everybody. So, you know, I really do think it is funding. And I think we have got an amazing amount of things that we can do around decarbonisation. Yep. If there's funding for it, we can kickstart, you know, a whole revolution there, really, in terms of environmental sustainability, if we get some funding for that. So I think there's lots of things we can do to kickstart a stalled economy if there is the right funding. We've got the partnerships, you know, we can access the land, you know, we've got the skills, we've got the capabilities. Quite a few housing associations have gone to the bond market recently and got amazingly low deals. So, you know, the investors are very keen. We can access those capital markets. Really what we need is a level of subsidy to enable that to happen, if we want things at the right price.
Which, well, it doesn't work if they're not at the right price, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's not affordable then, is it? So it's really, if we want that boost in affordable housing, then it's, you know, there's a level of subsidy that has to come from somewhere. So, and, you know, I think there's a huge amount of great will with local authorities as well, who are desperate to sort of do their part. We all know that it takes, you know, different industries in order to get this. That's before the housing crisis. It took all the industries, didn't it? It took everybody to do what they can. So it's going to be even more important to utilise every sort of lever and every organisation to keep things going.
Can I ask you, if you stare into your crystal ball, you've touched on environmental issues. Construction, there's obviously a lot of talk around modular and prefab or that kind of stuff. Planning is forever, you know, talked about at conferences that I'm sure we both attend. What do you think the future might look like 10 years from now? Because it is still a pretty inefficient exercise, is it not? I mean, I think, you know, taking a drawing for a building to a reality, what do you think will change over the next decade in order to expedite that process? And
well, I think there has been started to be more sort of regional conversations about sort of regional organisations who can take the lead, and I think that will help. I think we lost, quite a lot of capability when we got rid of some of those regional boards. So I do think we'll have to take a different approach in different regions. I also think that, you know, that there was quite a lot of gain through modern methods of construction, a lot of discussion around it, and a lot of goodwill. But this just goes to show at the moment that we need some consistency so that we can get things running and up and running, and we're not having a stop-start process. So I suppose my hope would be that over the next 10 years we have some consistency so that we can, you know, we take the politics out of housing, and we have a kind of a longer term approach with some consistencies, which means we can keep things going, because as soon as we ramp things up, they slow down again, and we're never going to get the right sort of modular construction methods going, the factories working properly, if we don't have some certainty. So, you know, I think it's a good time really to think about what are we going to need over the next 10 years, and, you know, let's have some long-term planning and long-term commitment for it.
I think that's possible. Do you still think?
I always hope. I don't know. I mean, I don't think we've managed it yet. But sometimes you need a bit of a crisis to give you that that kickstart. There's going to be a lot of calls on government, isn't there, for money. You know, they're not going to be able to refuse the NHS, are they? You know, that's going to be sort of top of everybody's list. So I think, you know, the calls are going to be loud, and people are going to be shouting, you know, business is going to be shouting, retail, hospitality. I mean, if you're in those businesses, I mean, it's so tough. So there's going to be a lot of calls on government in terms of money. But in a way, this is an easy one, because it's not, you know, if you can give more clarity and consistency over a period of time, then organisations find ways of keeping things going and setting things up. But if you don't have it, then you're always going to have that risk buffer in there, because, you know, everybody has to have their risk buffer, don't they?
Yes, I think so. And
it's just got bigger.
Most people are eating into those as we speak.
Yeah, it's got bigger.
So let's just move the conversation on a little bit on that front. Again, back to the sort of talent and what skills do you think you may require in the future, or what do you think you'll require more of 10 years from now than you do today?
Well, I think the sort of push forward in terms of more digital organisations is just going to carry on. I mean, we've all been talking about that, but, you know, the need is going to be ever greater. So not just the technology skills, but how you can apply it in organisations and how you can find those efficiencies and those systems of that customer focus, I think, is going to be really important. I do think climate change is going to be massive. There's going to be a lot of push for making sure we are ahead on the decarbonisation agenda, and I think the skills that go with that, even if they are within the mainstream of every organisation, people are going to have a broader range of skills that they can apply. And then I think business continuity planning, I reckon, and you know, fire safety has been the thing of the day. You know, we've all been desperately as housing organisations, that building safety agenda is going to be around for the next 10, 20 years. It's going to take us that long to go through every building and work out what needs to be done. So, you know, more, that's going to continue. So, you know, building safety, fire, project management skills, those are all going to be top of our list. And I think business continuity planning, you know, people who can cope with all these crisis changes, I think there'll probably be quite a lot around that.
Oh my God. Well, I'm not sure how many more I can cope with. Yeah, I'm not your guy. Let me ask you about your career. I can see you've achieved what you've achieved, which is just unbelievably impressive. But I sense there's plenty more. There may be more tricks up your sleeve. Is there unfinished business at Thames Valley, or do you have a plan around evolving your skill set? How do you think about your career? It's really interesting for younger people, particularly in our sector.
I think it's always about trying to get as broad a skill set as possible. So, I mean, you mentioned that I was on the board of McCarthy and Stone. So I was on housing associations boards. I was put on housing associations board as well as part of, those that are in difficulty, helping them get out of difficulty. But then I sort of thought, well, I know about housing associations and, you know, I like working in the housing association. So what other skills can I get? And I actually went on the board of Scope, which is a charity, and a national charity. And I learned a huge amount about how they talk about their customer and, their focus as well. And then felt, well, I really want to be in a private, sector organisation where the focus is really very different. And, you know, McCarthy and Stone is a great organisation because it's actually, it's a PRC, so you're in PRC world, but it actually has lots of traits of a housing association in that you're managing property, you've got a customer base, you're selling as well as building. So, but it's a completely, different, it's a totally commercial organisation. And so I think if you're working in a sector, but you want to broaden your horizons, it's about trying to have a network and accessing, different organisations and different ways of thinking as much as possible. And I think we've got a lot of that through the partnerships, investors that came in and invested in Fizzy, partnerships we have with Vistry, where we've done about, sort of huge number of projects now over a period of time. How do they think? What skills do they have in their organisations? How are they different from you? Where are they the same? And in a lot of our sort of, very small community and public health as well, all local authorities think in very different ways. And I think it's really interesting to see their models and what works them and how you can apply some of that within your own organisation. And so I think, for younger people, it's just try and get as broad a horizon as possible. And you're not going to get that in your own organisation. You need to talk to people who are totally different to you. And that's how you broaden your horizons, really.
That's really good advice. Let me ask you, is there a skill, professional skill you don't have that you wish you did? Is there something you might have acquired along the way that
Well, there's loads. I do think sort of project management. I'm not a natural project manager. I have to have them around me. But I think I would have liked probably to spend a bit more time really looking at that sort of project management skills. I mean, I've been lucky in that I've been able to have people around me who do that for me. But I suppose it's the things you're not so good at, you really admire in other people, don't you? So I really admire that in other people.
Well, I'm from an outsider looking in, you seem to be delivering plenty of projects.
yeah.
If that's a weakness, then crikey. you've got some strength. So tell me about the thing. What's the thing you love most about your job?
I love leading people and just getting the best out of people. And I really like the engagement with our customers. I love going, give me a difficult tenant meeting. I love that. Give me a, sitting down with residents and understanding the challenges that they face and, seeing what we can do and how we can help as an organisation in those communities. I really enjoy that. And I love, you know, I love the sort of building the partnerships with other people and thinking, thinking about what skills they've got and how we can work together better. I really enjoy all of that.
What's the bit you could ditch?
Well, I think there's a kind of, and you have to have it, but it's that regulatory, you know, the all the sort of requirements that there are on us from sort of different bodies, whether that's you know, the housing regulator or the CQC or this. So you kind of have this sort of structure around you. You've got to make sure all the time that you're ticking all those boxes and you're doing things in the right way. And I'm sure that's very good for us. But I think all of that governance, sometimes I think those are the bits where you think, well, I would really love to just get on at speed, but I need to make sure that we're also fulfilling the requirements over here.
Understood. I think really well put as well. Oh, I can put it like that. So Boris is back to work. It's his second day having recuperated, and I understand he's been listening to our podcasts whilst he's been laid up for the
past. Has he?
I'm told. He hasn't told me. Yeah. But what message would you have for the Prime Minister of Great Britain, COVID 2020? I know it's COVID-19, but in 2020.
Yeah.
What is the one thing that the Prime Minister should do to, you know, if we had a housing crisis before this, I presume we're most definitely going to have one afterwards. What's the one thing, if you were Prime Minister tomorrow, what would you do around housing?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's about what I said before, is give us a priority. There are many other calls on in terms of ask for money. But if we were a priority, we, through building new homes and building the right homes that are affordable for people, then we will solve many other problems that he will have. You know, we'll get people back to work, we'll increase productivity, you know, we'll house people so they'll have less problems in school, less health problems. You know, every pound that he puts into us, we make go an awful long way. So I would say, as a priority, and, you know, include the housing association sector as part of the solution, because we are here to help.
I wholeheartedly agree, and I really hope that's what we see. I couldn't agree with you more on that front. So I'm very conscious of your time. You're a very busy lady, very important, and I'm very, very grateful for the time you're giving me. So what we like to do before we wrap up is just ask a few quick fire questions. Is that
okay? Go for it.
I've got five.
Okay.
Glass of fizz or a cocktail?
Fizz.
Beach or adventure holiday?
Adventure holiday.
Bowie or the Beatles?
Beatles.
Office or remote working?
Office.
Okay, and the final question we ask everybody is, if you could own one property in the world, anywhere in the world, what would it be and why?
Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal, because the first time I saw it was a very big adventure for me, going to India and meeting loads of me. And then when they took me there, I was just gobsmacked by it, really, and all the people that kind of keep it going. I suppose it's the most impactful building in my life that I've seen so far.
You're not the first person to say that to me.
Really?
No, but they always look the same in the eyes when they say it, and I hear it is mind-blowing in reality. So yes, that's a pretty good building. Geeta, I just want to thank you so much for doing this with us.
And thank you.
I really, really appreciate it. The work you do is just incredible. And that goes for, of course, your team as well. And I thank you on behalf of Londoners. And I wish you every success.
Post-COVID. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Bye. Bye-bye. Keep safe. Bye.
You can join the DS movement by visiting ds.devrilsmith.com and you will receive the latest DevCast episode direct to your inbox.